When you look into the long and prolific life of Benjamin Franklin, you can expect to be encouraged by his lifelong curiosity and can-do spirit.
He was, I think, the first self-help author in the U.S.
Coming up, Eric Weiner explains how Franklin's travels made him an ambassador of the new American nation.
I would argue that there would be no United States of America if it were not for Ben Franklin's great seduction of France in the late 1770s.
Some parts of the USA have come up with local comfort foods that you just won't find anywhere else. Matthew Gavin Frank explores delicacies from the sweet, sunny South.
The name of hummingbird cake is called that because apparently there's so much sugar in it that if you eat an entire piece, your heart starts fluttering like the wings of a hummingbird.
And listeners tell us the highlights of their travels across North America. Come along for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Among the men we call America's founding fathers, Ben Franklin might be the first one who actually lived what we think of as the American dream. Author Eric Weiner has been investigating what makes Franklin the one we all seem to enjoy the most. In just a bit, he'll tell us how Franklin's goal to be useful, well into his 80s, included lots of travel, keeping an open mind, and a wicked sense of humor. And we check in with listeners about their travels, not too far from home in the U.S. and its neighbors. After running a breakfast joint in Juneau, catering parties in Taos, and sautéing snapper in Key West, Matthew Gavin Frank has learned some attention-getting backstories to local food favorites in all 50 states. He's here to dish up a few treats from the American South that he features in his book, The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. Matt, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm so predisposed to look at history and museums and architecture and art to get an insight into a culture, but you can do the same thing through the cuisine. You really show that as you travel around the United States and learn about each state's culture. You probably end up choosing the cuisine, and then that leads you to learn more about that state.
Yeah, it's a great lens through which to tumble down the rabbit hole, because eventually, you know, I'll begin by talking to a chef and then talk to somebody at a historical society, and one person leads to another, which leads to another, and you just kind of start gathering all of this wonderful information.
I would think this experience gave you a better appreciation of how distinct the cultures are from state to state in our country, because if you just drive the interstate across the country, you might not notice all of these actual deep differences.
That's true. There's a lot of distinct culture that varies from state to state. And of course, within each state, there are so many various subcultures that are distinct as well. But one of the things that wonderfully unifies us is our pride when it comes to state dishes and our joy of eating them.
That's so true. The pride and the joy. Now let's start this tour. Our tour guide is Matthew Gavin Frank. We're going to take an ecstatic tour through America's food, and we're going to look at the South. We're going to start with Florida. What's the iconic dish in Florida, and what does that tell us about that culture?
Well, I chose key lime pie for Florida. I actually spent 3.5 years working and living in the Florida Keys. Key lime pie was pretty ubiquitous there. A lot of the food historians in South Florida tend to believe that key lime pie was invented by Florida Keys sponge fishermen in the late 1800s. They were bound to their boats for days on end, and they packed canned condensed milk because it was high energy. They packed a protein source that would spoil less rapidly than meat, so that was eggs. And then they foraged the local trees for key limes. And eventually, they mixed all of those things together, set it out in the sun to cook. So the original key lime pies actually spoiled a little. And that's how key lime pie essentially was invented. They're cooked today now, of course, to prevent salmonella. Yeah.
So much time has passed, and it's still the beloved dish. I think we better, for our own benefit, we better go to Arkansas now.
All right. This might be a little less sexy, but the dish I chose for Arkansas was beaver tail stew. I actually was traveling a lot in Arkansas's hill country and was hanging out with folks who still do a lot of subsistence living in Arkansas and a lot of trapping. And so one of the old kind of lost, you can't quite call it typical of Arkansas these days, but it's kind of like a lost heritage dish of Arkansas. And because I found myself in these communities, I found myself eating it, and I found myself becoming just absolutely enamored of it, quite frankly.
It's literally a beaver tail?
It's literally a beaver tail. There are actually bakeries that make big sort of like hot waffles that they call beaver tails. But those are riffs on the original real deal, literal beaver tail stew.
So you've got recipes at the end of each one of your chapters. Really briefly, what goes into a beaver tail stew? How do you make it?
More than anything, the most important thing about the beaver tail stew is boiling it for long enough so it's edible. But you kind of season a beaver tail on both sides, sear it in a hot fat in a stock pot on both sides. And once it's sufficiently browned, add a bit of stock, chicken stock. You could just add water. And then there's usually like a bunch of aromatics in there. Thyme, parsley, bay leaf, tarragon, rosemary, leek, onion, garlic, carrot, celery and things. Then essentially it's cooked for at least 6 hours until it's soft and until it kind of pulls. Then bring your bowl. There's like a gaminess to it. If I were to, I guess on the continuum between a mild lamb and a gamey chicken, I guess I would put beaver tail right there in the middle.
All right, let's cross the border. Let's head over to Alabama. What's the iconic dish in Alabama, and what insight does that give us to the local culture?
Oh, goodness. For Alabama, I chose hummingbird cake, which is, I guess the easiest way to describe it would be, it's kind of like a banana, pineapple, pecan cake with essentially enough sugar in there to put an entire colony of carpenter ants into shock. It's a very, very, very sweet cake. I love it. I love it. I'm not saying that negatively. I love it. And the name of hummingbird cake, it's called that because apparently there's so much sugar in it that if you eat an entire piece, your heart starts fluttering like the wings of a hummingbird.
Oh, my goodness. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Matthew Gavin Frank. His book is The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. And we're joining Matthew now for a tour of the South. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. And Sid's on the line from Atlanta in Georgia. Sid, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, do you have some thoughts on iconic foods and how they reflect the state's culture in your corner of the country?
Rick, I hope you'll allow me to talk about my native state of South Carolina.
Please do.
I was lucky enough to grow up in the what's called the low country of South Carolina, and for that reason, rice grown by family members of generations back must have inspired the enormous role that rice plays in the southern diet in the low country of South Carolina. And I would want to honor that tradition because of both its connection to my own family, the fact that low-lying areas, almost canals, were developed and rice was grown and harvested. And, of course, it was the wild rice, so nutritious, but it has morphed into a very important staple within Southern culture in general, but in South Carolina, particularly from the Charleston and Lowcountry area. So I want to vote for rice.
So is this red rice you're talking about?
Yes, it tastes like home to me.
Well, thank you, Sid. And Matthew, when we think of South Carolina, you came up with a rice dish, didn't you, for your iconic dish?
That's right. I'm right there with you, Sid. I chose purlieu. I chose purlieu. Which, I mean, depending on who you talk to, folks describe it as the sister to jambalaya, the brother to rice pilaf, the cousin to paella, but very much its own thing. So the chef I spoke to who contributed a recipe for purlieu, a fellow named Forrest Parker at the Old Village Post House in Charleston, uses specifically Charleston gold rice, fluffs it after it's cooked specifically with a utensil that he told me is known as a Charleston rice spoon.
Long handle.
Yep. So rice is incredibly important. Really, really wonderful stuff.
Hey, Matthew and Sid, let's move along. We're just about out of time, but we've got Sid on the line from Atlanta, and I wanted to go to Georgia with Matthew. Matthew, you chose peach pie, right, for your dish in Georgia?
How could I not choose something with peaches in Georgia? Yep.
Sid, what would you say is the iconic dish for your state of Georgia?
Well, you know, the peach figures prominently in all areas, symbolically, and on road signs, the peach state. So we have regional dishes that will, whenever peaches are truly in season, they come to the fore, whether it's milkshakes or fried pies, fried peach pies, which is a delicacy only the best of fry cooks can do. But anything with the peach is going to win fans in my part of the world. And I would recommend that the peach in all of its many forms, from pickled peaches to peach cobbler, all of those are great representations of Georgia.
Sid, it sounds like a slam dunk. For Georgia, it's got to be peaches. Thanks for your call.
Okay.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Matthew Gavin Frank. It's been a sweet tour of the South. Matthew's book is The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. And Matthew, we're out of time. I just want to finish with one more state. Of course, there's lots more states, but tell me just for an example about how Mississippi has an iconic dish and what that might teach us about the state of Mississippi.
Absolutely. For Mississippi, I went with Mississippi mud pie. I know we've been talking about a lot of sweet dishes in the South. It's funny, when I went to Mississippi, they basically were telling me, when I was talking about the Mississippi mud pie, they said there are four levels of sweetness. There's sweet, very sweet, Alabama sweet, and then Mississippi sweet. And the Mississippi sweet was the sweetest of the bunch. And the Mississippi mud pie did not disappoint when it was presented to me. It was incredibly sweet. It's essentially a chocolate cookie crust with a little bit of flourless chocolate cake suspended in there, a little chocolate pudding topping, and then a little bit of whipped cream on top of that. And it's said that Mississippi mud pie was made to kind of represent the richness of the mud that is at the bottom of the Mississippi River.
Ah, there you get the name, the Mississippi mud pie. Every country, every state has its own insights, and you've really demonstrated very tastefully that it can be an insight that's gained by understanding the local cuisine. Matthew Gavin Frank, thanks so much for being our tour guide as we enjoy, with your help, The Mad Feast, an ecstatic tour through America's food. Happy eating and happy travels.
Thank you, Rick.
He's got big ribs and candied yams, sugar-cured Virginia ham, basement full of those berry jams.
Matt's also the author of several books of poetry and teaches creative writing at Northern Michigan University. His website is matthewgfrank.com. The founding father you'd probably most enjoy sharing a drink with is Benjamin Franklin. When you look into all that he accomplished well into his 80s, it can inspire you to be a better version of yourself at any age. Eric Weiner tells us how Franklin encourages him to age gracefully. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. What do the lives of Americans from more than 200 years ago have to say for how we live today? Author Eric Weiner looked into the life of the most colorful of the founding fathers. He soon learned that Benjamin Franklin's many exploits, experiments, endeavors, and travels can still offer us a lesson in how to live a long and useful life. Eric's written Ben and Me to explore Ben Franklin, warts and all, and to find how his 18th century life can help us feel satisfied with our lives today. Eric's on the line from his hotel in Rome right now, where he's on the way to host a writer's workshop in Bhutan. Eric, you're releasing Ben and Me at a time when interest in Franklin seems to be having a sudden surge. Michael Douglas is starring in an Apple TV series about Ben Franklin. Ken Burns just released a 4-hour profile of Franklin on PBS. And now your book looks at how much Ben Franklin accomplished in his 84 years.
He has aged very well in his afterlife, and in fact, he aged very well during his life. And he really had his best years toward the end of his life. As I like to say, the first two-thirds of his life were amazing, but the last third is when really Franklin became Franklin. You know, that's when he negotiated treaties with France and helped win the Revolutionary War. It's when he signed the U.S. Constitution. So he was extremely active well into his 60s, 70s, and 80s.
There's so much to talk about with Ben Franklin. And first of all, he's a founding father, and that's a big deal in our political discourse lately. In your book, you call Ben Franklin the founder of our times, opposed to the other founders. Is that what you mean?
He was a founding grandfather, I would say, because he did live to such a ripe old age, who established the ideas that still resonate with us today, laid the groundwork for our democracy, and really for the American dream. And you can make the case, and it's a pretty easy case to make, actually, that Ben Franklin was the first person to dream the American dream and to achieve the American dream. Don't forget that he grew up pretty dirt poor in Boston, son of a candle maker, not a lot of money, 2 years of formal education, you know, compared with Jefferson attending law school and that sort of thing. And Franklin was, I think, the most open-minded of the founders. I mean, look, he had his blinders on like everyone else. He was, you know, unable to fully escape the ethics and morals of his times when it came to issues like slavery. But he was really open-minded. He had a scientist temperament, an empirical temper. He was always testing his own ideas. And, you know, he gave this famous speech at age 81, I believe it was, at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, closing remarks, which said basically, you know, this document, the Constitution, is not perfect, but I don't know if it'll ever be perfect. And I have problems with it. But as I get older, I begin to doubt my convictions more. And so many people, as they get older and older, can be 40 or can be 70, they become more set in their ways and more absolutist. Right. And not Franklin.
He was like you said, the grandfather. And at the same time, I guess if I wanted to have a beer with one of the founders, I'd want to have a beer with Ben Franklin.
Yeah, you'd probably be a glass of Madeira wine, because he loved Madeira and he drank about a bottle a day. So he definitely enjoyed life. But he is, you know, more relaxed than the others. He was funnier, definitely funnier.
Funny.
I mean, he was the original humorist of America. So, yeah, you'll want to have that glass of Madeira with Ben.
When you think about how funny he is, he had satirical columns, and just his style of writing was clever, wasn't it?
Yes. He wrote these scathing satires. You know, the purpose of satire is to make us laugh, but also to make us think, and he was very good at that. He also would try on these different masks. You know, he would write under pseudonyms, dozens and dozens of them, everything from a middle-aged widow in Boston to the King of Prussia, and he was very adept at that.
I like, and he had, there's proverbs or whatever phrases that we still enjoy today. Fish and visitors stink after 3 days. Classic Franklin.
So true. And he, you know, a lot of these, I'm going to be honest, he borrowed from other places and he Franklinized them. He made them pithier and sharper. And it's the Franklin version of these sayings that we remember today. That's from Poor Richard's Almanac, which he put out once a year, under a pseudonym, Richard Saunders, who was not a real person, but was Ben Franklin wearing another mask.
Eric Weiner is introducing us to American founding father Ben Franklin right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Franklin is the subject of his newly released book, Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Eric's a former correspondent for NPR, and you see his byline at times on online articles for BBC Travel. Eric also hosts writers' workshops in Bhutan. Details are on his website, ericweinerbooks.com, and that's spelled W-E-I-N-E-R. You know, Eric, your book really is not a conventional biography. It's a look at how we can benefit from Ben Franklin's sort of status as the original self-help evangelist, creating a better vision for ourselves. Talk about that for a bit.
Yeah. No, I set out to write a book, as you say, that was not a conventional biography. I described the book as a chronicle of my relationship with Benjamin Franklin. Now, I realize he's been dead for quite a while, but he lives on in his writing, in his words, and in the places that I travel in his footsteps. And he was, I think, the first self-help author in the U.S. He wrote his autobiography, never finished it, but I wrote a good chunk of it. And in it, he lays out basically how he succeeded in life. It's very practical, very American in that sense. And he's like, I started off poor as a candle maker's son, and here's what I did to succeed, and here's what you too, reader, can do. And now, today, Rick, you know, you go into the bookstore, you see all these self-help books that essentially say the same thing. Empower yourself and do this. But Franklin started this genre, and he focused on habits. You know, there are all these best-selling books today about, you know, atomic habits and great habits. Franklin had his 13 habits, 13 virtues that he wanted to adhere to. As a young man, he came up with this list, And he came up with a very systematic way of approaching it. I'm going to focus on one virtue, be it honesty or fortitude or celibacy. He wasn't so good at that.
It's kind of like the Boy Scout one, trustworthy, loyal, friendly, helpful, courteous, kind, brave, clean, and reverent.
Kind of like that, or the ancient Greek virtues. I mean, virtues had been around for a while, but he systematized them. He divided his notebook into sort of a grid pattern, and each week he would follow a different virtue. And anytime he strayed from that virtue, he would make a mark in his book.
So what's something that you've benefited from his wisdom in your life?
I think his focus on usefulness. I mean, from a young age, he decided he was going to be useful. Hmm. And look, my father was a doctor, my mother was a school teacher, and I thought, well, you know, they're useful. But I began to question, as I approached a big birthday that features the number 6, have I been useful? And how can I be more useful? And I realized that more than his, you know, economic policy or his role as a founding father, it was this notion of being useful to other people that animated Franklin's life.
He probably could have just retired and lived well at the age of 60, but he had 24 useful years after that, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, you know, golfing in Florida was beckoning to him. It was calling.
Yeah.
And he said no. And he kept going. And look, all these studies today show that, you know, people who retire and do nothing don't live very long. Your life needs to be filled with meaning. And Franklin, until the very end, his life was filled with meaning and purpose and usefulness.
And he traveled a lot to do that. This is a travel show, and Ben Franklin,
yes,
arguably was the most well-traveled American of his day. You calculated what? He crossed the Atlantic 8 times and logged 42,000 miles? Frequent
sailor.
That's
a lot of miles. That would be a lot of miles today. That was a lot of miles back then. He traveled up and down the Eastern Seaboard as Postmaster General in the colonies. He lived in London for 17 years, France for 8 years. He visited Scotland, Ireland, the Netherlands, Germany.
Oh.
he got around, and you think about, you know, imagine a month at sea and you don't know if you're going to make it. You know, his wife, Deborah, would not travel across the Atlantic for good reason. It was dangerous. There were storms and shipwrecks and pirates. So you had to really want to travel back then, and he did.
Whoa. And he did it 8 times. You know, when I think about the commitment and the courage to go between America and Europe back then as a very important person. He was arguably the most famous American and the most famous American in Europe during those days, wasn't he?
In the latter part of his life. So he really achieved fame with his electrical experiments when he was in his early 40s. And he was hugely, hugely popular in Europe, especially in France. They loved him in France, and Franklin loved them.
So what did they think about when they saw Ben Franklin? Was he like this Wild West man, or was he a sophisticate?
Yeah, they saw him as sort of this like backwoodsman's philosopher. You know, he didn't wear a wig in Paris in 1776 when he moved there. And this was a great scandal because everyone wore a wig. But he just wore this fur cap, Martin fur cap, which he had picked up on an expedition to Canada.
Wow.
And they saw him as this, today we'd call him crunchy, this crunchy philosopher. He was
and
so
it was
simple.
Probably charming to the French, I would think.
Yes, he was wise and congenial and funny, and he liked what they liked. He liked wine, he liked good company, he liked music. He knew enough in France that if you're going to seduce the French, and it was a great seduction, right? The American Continental Army needed French support, and Franklin was the perfect person to dispatch to France for this mission because he understood them. He understood you don't conduct business over breakfast, as John Adams would have it. You do it over dinner with a bottle or 5 of wine.
And that was quite consequential just for the future of the United States of America.
I would argue that there would be no United States of America if it were not for Ben Franklin's great seduction of France in the late 1770s.
Author Eric Weiner is known for his bestsellers, The Geography of Bliss, The Geography of Genius, and The Socrates Express. He's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to talk about what he discovered about Benjamin Franklin and writes about in his latest book, Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Now, when he traveled, I mean, we know he went as the ambassador to France for, what, like 8 or 9 years?
Right, right.
He also traveled to other places. What are some episodes from those travels that were impactful for him and can be inspiring for us?
At age 70, in 1776, he's back in Philadelphia before he goes to France, and he's dispatched by the Congress at the time to Montreal. This was an overland journey. He's 70 years old. He's suffering from gout and kidney stones and a bunch of ailments, and they go by carriage. They go by boat. It's March, but it's freezing cold. It was a tremendous failure. He was trying to get the Canadians to join the American cause, and it was duty first. He said, never question an assignment. And that really impressed me. Not many people know that he spent all of 2 weeks in Montreal, but he did. That's one example. Another is in London when he's representing Pennsylvania and a number of colonies, how he had this sort of innate diplomatic ability to win people over. He would, his sort of bete noire was John Adams, who was over in Europe at about the same times. And Adams was a real bulldog. You know, he was just in your face and very aggressive. And Franklin was the exact opposite. He was the consummate negotiator. He was calm. He was in no rush. And he knew that the relationship was more important than the problem.
And was this in his early years or his later years?
This is his later years.
You know, it just occurred to me, today we've got a big discussion about Biden and his age,
yep.
You know. What parallels can we draw from that?
It's a really good question. I've been thinking a lot about this. So Franklin, turns out, was the exact age, almost to the month, 81, when he attended the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 as the oldest delegate, almost the exact age to the month as Biden will be when the November election comes around. And ageism is nothing new, Rick. It existed back then, and he was old enough to be the grandfather of most of the other delegates. They were like, well, you know, he's great, but who is this guy now? But they listened to him. You know, he actually brought a lot of wisdom to the convention. He helped craft a compromise, which led to the House and the Senate between among the states, proportional representation in the House and two senators per state, which we still have today. You know, I'm not going to say he was every day, you know, in the weeds negotiating, right. But he brought this sagacity to it.
Sagacity, that's a good
sagacity.
Word.
Sagacity.
Sageness, you mean?
Yeah. And people listened to that wisdom. And he was, even his voice was too hoarse to deliver his speeches. He had a friend deliver them, but the words were powerful and they made a difference.
Eric, this is so fun talking about Ben Franklin. He's such a fascinating, intriguing, and the more you know about him, more inspirational character, and so American. When you think about the fraught times that he lived and worked in, and you think about today when we're so divided and our politics are so challenged and our government, to a lot of people, just seems so broken, how can Franklin inspire us to be Americans together? And what would Franklin recommend as we deal with our challenges today?
One thing I discovered researching this book is that divided America is nothing new. Back in Franklin's time, you were very much so either a Virginian or a Pennsylvanian or a Massachusetts. You were that first and foremost before you were an American. So the divisions were even deeper in a way. But one thing that Franklin brings to the table is the power of doubt. He was a tremendous doubter. And I think this came from his scientific background, his electrical experiments, because the scientific method is always this perennial process of reaching conclusions and then discarding those conclusions based on new evidence. And that's what Franklin excelled at. And he brought that to the political world. That's the thing. He didn't just keep it to science. He brought it to politics.
How did Franklin change his mind on issues of importance in
well,
the day?
Well, the big one is slavery, I think. Well, there's lots of big ones, but one is slavery, that he had enslaved people, seven throughout his life, approximately, far fewer than Jefferson or Washington, but still. But by the time he was in his 70s and 80s, he had essentially freed these slaves and become a very vocal abolitionist. And I find that inspiring, that he was able to change his mind about a huge issue like that.
Such a respected man who had it all. Everybody thought he probably was so wise, and he actually reassessed that. Also, he started out as a loyalist, loyal to the crown, right?
Yeah, he was a proud subject of the British Empire. He was 69 years old when he had that change of heart while living in London, representing many of the colonies, where he just got fed up and realized that they were never going to come around to the colonies' demands. And I mean, think about that. At age 69, he became a rebel. And he had far more to lose and far less to gain by becoming a rebel than any of these other young firebrands like Samuel Adams at the time.
Oh, yeah. You know, earlier in our discussion, Eric, you said he was so American. What is so American?
Well, it's everything we think of as, I would say, the best qualities of an American today. Friendly and funny and warm and willing to do anything to overcome obstacles and not setting limits on what is achievable.
Hmm.
A poor son of a candle maker, 2 years of formal education, and he is granted honorary doctorates from Oxford University, becomes an international celebrity. It is the rags-to-riches story.
And an optimist.
An optimist, and I would describe him as a possibilian, someone who saw possibilities.
You know, Eric, I've always enjoyed Ben Franklin on the $100 bill. And apparently you do, too, because you put him on the cover of your book. But there's one fun little change on the cover of your book.
Yes.
What
he
is that change?
He is winking at us. As one of his biographers, Walter Isaacson, said that Franklin is the founder who winks at us, that he could be serious, he could be having some fun with you. There's something very coy and powerful and seductive about the wink. And Franklin was a winker. He was the founding winker, I would say.
Eric Weiner, thanks for joining us. Thanks for your book, Ben and Me, and learning from the wisdom of the founding father that winks at us.
A pleasure, as always, Rick.
We have links to Eric Weiner's prior appearances with us on The Geography of Bliss and The Geography of Genius. You can listen from links that we've posted with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Next, let's get some ideas for exploring our own country and our next-door neighbors. Where have you been traveling lately, not so far from home? We're at 877-333-RICK. By email, it's radio@ricksteves.com. Every so often on Travel with Rick Steves, we like to check in with you and hear how your travels have been working out. As you know, we specialize in travel ideas for Europe, but we also like to explore other destinations, both near and far. Right now, let's hear from you. How have your travels been going on this side of the pond? Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and you can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. Justin's calling in from Jacksonville in Florida.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I've been reminiscing about Canada Day, being it's summertime. My wife and I have been to Canada a number of times and have done 3 Canada Days in 3 different cities and had 3 different experiences. And so it's been pretty fun to celebrate Canada Day right around the 4th of July, because that's on July 1st.
Well, tell me more about how do the Canadians celebrate Canada Day? Is it just kind of like 4th of July, but with maple leaves and I don't know what Canadians eat, but something different?
Sure, a lot of poutine, right?
Poutine,
that's
right?
The big dish.
Yeah, but how is it? What do you do?
In Vancouver, yeah. Vancouver was very traditional, that you would expect, with the fireworks and the people on the streets. And we were there resting after the long train ride. We had taken the train from Toronto all the way across. And we were just laying around, and all of a sudden there was a huge mass of people outside. It was a giant parade went by, and we ended up going to Stanley Park. There was a huge procession, military garb, cannons being shot off, and fireworks at night, and just a really raucous party scene. And so that was a nice introduction and made us think, well, we got to get back to Canada for another Canada Day.
Canada Day tourism. Wow. So that was Vancouver. Were the other ones, places you went, different, or was it just more of the same?
No, definitely. We went to Toronto for one and went to the Blue Jays annual game, which ended up becoming an 18-inning marathon, and the manager was thrown out in the second inning of the game. And so we kind of missed the entire day's worth of festivities, but it was unique in the sense that we were there on the national day, and it was, again, another exciting crowd and a lot of fun, a lot of late-night antics, because by the time we all got out of there, it was dark, and it was sort of
18
spilled
innings.
Out of the street.
Whoa.
So that was exciting.
Yeah.
But the last one we went to was perhaps the most interesting. It was in Quebec City, where they don't really celebrate Canada Day at all. And so we didn't really think about that until we showed up. And when we got there, because I guess is it Jean the Baptiste Day is their big celebration.
Oh.
They do that a few days ahead of the event because they're sort of, you know, annexed from Canada.
So they've got a little chip on their shoulder. They don't want to celebrate their 4th of July, their Canada Day, because they're the French-speaking part of Canada.
Right. And so there was no celebration, nothing on the street. Business as usual. There was a single lone vendor selling red balloons in a square and little Canadian flags. and that was it.
So
we were
no
after
Canada
experiencing
Day.
Vancouver and Toronto, we were kind of shocked and sort of laughed at ourselves when we thought about the history of what was going on. And you know, people were looking at us like, Canada Day, get out of here with that. We don't want to talk about that.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, you got 2 out of 3.
Right, exactly. So we'll have to find another city to get to one of these days. Montreal might be the next place to check out for big cities in Canada.
Well, I hope you can go back there and have another one of those real soon.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thanks for talking to me.
Okay, take care. Happy travels. Dick's calling in from Langhorne in Pennsylvania. Hi, Dick.
Hey, Rick. How are you today?
Doing good. Do you have any thoughts about travel you'd like to share?
Well, my wife and I have spent a good part of the last 7 or 8 years traveling across the U.S. and Canada in our motorhome, and we're not full-timers, but pretty much better than half-timers, so we spend a lot of time, and we've had the opportunity to travel to 49 states. I haven't figured out how to drive to Hawaii, and we've traveled throughout Canada, but it's been a phenomenal experience, whether we're going to the iconic places like Yellowstone and Yosemite and the Painted Desert, and that list can go on, or places that nobody's ever heard of, like Wolford, North Dakota, and Tetonia, Idaho. And it's the people you meet, it's the things you do, and traveling to these places takes you through parts of the country that otherwise nobody had ever planned to drive through. And my wife and I have found that we can find beauty in almost everything we see and do throughout the country, whatever the time of year is. But you find these nuggets of history everywhere you go. We've just been fascinated by every place we've gone. In Arizona, they have one of the most incredible memorials to World War II with a large 16-inch gun from both the USS Arizona, the beginning of our entry into the war, and the Missouri, which is where the peace treaty was signed with Japan. And then you put that together with some of the places that driving around Crater Lake is got to be one of the most gorgeous experiences we've ever had, or the wildlife we've seen on our trip to Alaska, up to the Yukon, and I don't know how you can put a price on that.
Isn't that
great?
It's
so exciting.
I got to ask, you've spent a lot of time on the road. If you're on the road again, what road food would you be salivating about as you approach it on the highway?
It's interesting. There's a book we purchased called Road Food. What it basically says is some of the best road food in the country is old gas stations, which have been converted into restaurants. And we've experienced that, and we kind of go out of our way to find these places. I'd never had a hush puppy till we were on the road one time, and we went to this restaurant one night, and they said, would you like some hush puppies? We didn't know what they were, which may show our ignorance, but we always try to eat local food. If there's local wineries or breweries, we try and drink the craft beers and wines that are there. One quick story, we were in Tetonia, Idaho, and we ordered a pizza. Well, it took us 45 minutes. We found out why. They send somebody out who's between beers at the bar down to the local tea store at the gas station to get the pizza. They bring it up and heat it up in the microwave
and then
serve it.
Oh, that's so funny.
These are things that when you tell people, they think that really doesn't happen. But it's the beauty of our country and how diverse it is. We just get excited about it.
By the way, we've had the authors of that road food book on our show, Jane and Michael Stern, and they're just
great. Cool.
They are so enthusiastic about this quirky slice of Americana. Also, one thing I just love about is just the camaraderie on the road. I mean, it's just a wonderful community, isn't it?
It is a community of people, and you have an instant camaraderie with them because of things you're doing. And we found that the thing I found is people around the U.S. and Canada are wonderful.
You know,
people hear about unfriendliness, it's just not true.
I've been really sad about how divided our country is lately, and I'm just trying to think of positive ways, constructive ways where people can mix it up a little bit. Do you get a sense that this whole amazing RV sort of world with people driving all over the country, you park in a RV lot, there's no red state or blue state here, it's just a bunch of RVers. Does it bring people together in any way, or are there divided camps politically even in an RV park?
I think it becomes a bridge initially so that people find they've got something in common before that maybe they find out there's something that maybe would otherwise divide them. I think we have more in common with our neighbors and our friends and people around the country than we want to admit. They get hung up on the things that divide us, and they don't take advantage of finding the things they have in common, which are often a lot stronger.
And would it be fair to say that whereas certain pastimes might be predominantly people who are right-wing or left-wing, RVers are pretty much 50-50, just like our country is that way.
They're all over the lot.
They're all over the lot.
They really are.
So it's,
I mean, they are conservative, they're liberal, they're agnostic, they're religious. And I have found that this doesn't build barriers between the way maybe my wife and I feel and people we meet feel. We can have discussions, we can talk about these things and still sit down, have a glass of wine, be friends, and stay in touch with each other
years later. You're all creatures of the road together. That's great. Hey, Dick, thanks so much for sharing a good reminder about the fun we can have just exploring our own country in an RV.
I love your show. I listen to it every Sunday morning, believe it or not, at 5 a.m.
All right. Thanks a lot, and continued happy travels.
Good luck, Rick. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're hearing about where you've been traveling, near and far, right now on Travel with Rick Steves. You can join us in a future recording session by emailing your travel reports and observations to radio@ricksteves.com. And Tim's emailed us from Houston, and Tim writes, "While walking in a narrow street in Veracruz, in Mexico, my girlfriend and I decided to walk up a set of white stone steps and then up to a pair of old carved doors. We opened them, entering a tiny atrium with a narrow, curved staircase to the side. The noise of the street ceased completely when the doors closed behind us. Emboldened by the atmosphere, we walked up the stairs that ended at a small balcony. Looking down, we found ourselves in the middle of an intimate wedding ceremony. No one seemed to realize that they had an audience. The reverberation of the vows in this small chapel made for a very surreal experience, and my partner and I just marveled at how we were able to grab that opportunity. The lesson? Anytime you find steps in an open door, consider going inside." I love it. Thank you, Tim from Houston. And Nicole's calling in from Flagstaff, Arizona. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. It sounds like you've had a great experience up in the Pacific Northwest.
I sure love the Pacific Northwest. So I'm originally from Germany, but now I live in Arizona. And I love being up in the Pacific Northwest near the ocean. And many years ago, I had this wonderful experience where I was at the shore and I saw a pod of orcas swimming by. And that moment, I just want to say it was life-changing. So that actually inspired me to do my next Canada trip based on those whales. I just wanted to see more of them. But instead of chasing them with a speedboat, like with a commercial outfitter, I thought, well, what if I just find a spot near the shore or out on a kayak to give myself a chance of maybe seeing them? So I thought, well, I'll ask around. And then I also hopped on Google Maps and I zoomed in to one of the areas that people kind of recommended further up Vancouver Island. And I was looking for whale shapes, humpback whales, and I found some very famed shapes that I know they weren't boats. You know, you can zoom in on Google Maps, but I saw them like in twos or threes, like one or two big ones, one small one. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I think those could be whales. And based on that, I kind of designed my last Canada trip. I thought, okay, I see there's a bunch of them here in this area on Google Maps. Let's see, where's a campground close by, or where can I find my Airbnb? And so I based it on that.
And that's a very good tool. I mean, a generation ago, who would have thunk, you know? And you were not disappointed.
No, I think I was really lucky, but I also did my research. Yeah.
But you know what? When you talk about not chasing them, but just observing and letting it happen, I think there's something very tranquil about that. And too many people chase animals. You know, people chase animals, but you just want to be an observer.
Exactly. I don't want to chase them. I don't want to make like a huge noise with the speedboat. I want to observe them almost as if I'm invisible. I'm just a curious visitor in their realm.
Yeah, the highlight of my cruise up in Alaska, I was up on a small ship in Alaska, and we would just hang out in the bay in our kayak. And I would hang out at where the river hit the bay, and the bears would come down, and they'd go fishing, and they'd grab their salmon, and they would just paw it right out of the white water. And then they'd walk up to a little bluff, and they'd sit there, and they'd eat salmon fresh out of the river, just like I would have a picnic. And for me to be there, I don't think they saw me. I wasn't moving. I was just kind of there. And there was sort of a magic about that. And I feel like you had that when you were just observing the pod of orcas.
Yeah, there's a magic about that because your whole thinking shifts. Instead of a zoo experience where animals are caged, you enter their realm and you become a visitor, I guess. And there is such beauty and magic in that, for sure.
I think part of that is the fact that that's going to happen there with or without you. And you are just there, and you're just part of that natural wonder. Hey, you're from Germany, and I know that Germans love their nature, and they love to go to the Black Forest and regenerate and walk.
Yes.
And they love to go to the foothills of the Alps and so on. Where in Germany could you have that beautiful nature experience? I don't think you're going to see a pod of orcas, but where would you see something that is just as majestic?
Right. It depends on what you're looking for, but I think the German soul, if you go back like in art history, the Romantic area, and in German literature and poetry, you find that. And Germans, they love going into the forest, even on little forest trails. But say, for example, you're heading into southern Germany near the Alps. Maybe instead of just Munich and just the castle, maybe you can build in a day where you seek out a mountain trail that's not like too popular and just immerse yourself in nature. Do the forest bathing.
Forest bathing. I love that. That's it's fun. I always think of that as a Japanese concept, but you can do it
wherever
you travel.
I agree. Wherever you go, you can seek out those experiences and be refreshed.
Thank you so much, Nicole, for your insight and inspiring us to be quiet and don't chase the animals, but let it happen.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, happy travels.
Happy travels. Bye.
And Bonnie in Philadelphia emailed us. She wrote about her response to our talk with Christopher P. Baker about visiting Cuba. Bonnie writes, "My husband, son, and I went to Cuba a few months ago and were touched by the warmth of the Cuban people and the beauty of their island. We were surprised that they liked us and were so friendly and didn't resent Americans. The Cubans that we met seemed to be able to separate us from our government. It was so sad to see the long lines of people waiting for groceries at stores with empty shelves, the long lines at bus stops for buses that never seemed to come, and the general hardship under which they were living. In order to get a visa, we had to give ourselves a classification, and our classification was in support of the Cuban people. We stayed at a locally owned B&B and ate all our meals at privately owned restaurants, attended local music performances, and enjoyed the arts and culture. We hired the local tour guides and drivers and have become friends with several of them. Cuba sure surprised us in so many ways. We now encourage our friends to make a visit, and we plan to return." Wow, Bonnie, that is like an email I could have sent in after going there with my family also. I've never met anybody who went to Cuba on their own that wasn't similarly impressed by the people of that complicated island with such a rich history and a fraught relationship with our country. The very best thing I did is exactly what you did. I hired a local guide who was also a driver. And that way we had our translator, we had our local comedian, we had our negotiator, we had somebody who could pick us up at our B&B and drop us at our B&B at the end of the day. We made more friends, and we certainly learned more about what we were looking at. I guess I just would say, if you had an opportunity to go to Cuba, I imagine you're thankful you did. And if you're dreaming to go to Cuba, judging by the feedback we get from our travelers, it's a lot of fun. Yvonne in Houston writes to us about an adventure she had visiting a mountain city in Oaxaca City in Mexico. "We boarded a van in Pochulca, Mexico, and wound our way up the Sierra Madre del Sur, going north from the Pacific coast. We were bound for Oaxaca City. The van driver made a hairpin turn every 30 seconds for almost 5 hours. I loved the views, gorgeous, sweeping vistas of the mountainous jungles below and plunging drop-offs that added to the already agitated state of my stomach. We stopped behind a rickety old local bus that had broken down. Guess what? We jammed all the passengers from that bus into our van and stopped at villages all along the way, dropping them off at their destinations. Finally, we arrived at Oaxaca City, a 16th century Spanish colonial town famous for its chocolate, its Zapotec weavings, and its famous archaeological site of Monte Alban. I walked into a church that surely must have been shipped from Italy with its lavish gold-covered Baroque altar and ceiling. Ah, to enjoy Oaxaca City in the charming Las Mariposas, an inn once the home of a Spanish family with its multiple patios and delicious breakfast served with homemade breads and sweets and café de olla, that's coffee from a jar. All this certainly helped me endure winding back down those same hairpin turns through the Sierras. Afterward, my brain recouped while staring out at the turquoise waters, reclined on the beach on Oaxaca's southern Pacific coast, my mind drifting out to sea. Wow, Yvonne in Houston, Texas. Great report from Oaxaca, down in Mexico.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Quirt. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
The Rick Steves guidebooks are consistently the best-selling series of guides to Europe. That's because we lovingly update them in person and cut through all the superlatives to give you hard and smart opinions based on decades of experience. Find them at your favorite bookseller and at ricksteves.com.